Cher Franck Guéry, au nom de tous ici présents, je vous souhaite la bienvenue au Collège de France. I will speak in French. You know, here it's almost mandatory. So, je vous souhaite la bienvenue au Collège de France pour cette grande conférence dont vous êtes après Anish Kapoor et Enrique Villamatas, mais avant Mario Vargas Llosa, le troisième et très prestigieux invité. Donc, je remercie Jean-Louis Cohen. You get it? Doesn't matter. I will give you the text after. Professeur à l'Université de New York et titulaire d'une chaire internationale au Collège de France, d'avoir œuvré à votre présence ce soir. C'est avec lui que, dans un instant, vous dialoguerez pour notre plus grande instruction. Vous serez peut-être sensible... Vous serez peut-être sensible au fait que Christian de Portzamparc a enseigné dans cet amphithéâtre, comme Pierre Boulez, en l'honneur de qui vous venez de construire à Berlin le bel ovale de la salle Pierre Boulez, en collaboration avec l'acousticien Yasuhisa Toyota. Certaines de vos œuvres sont connues de tous, en particulier de ceux qui, de Los Angeles à Bilbao, en passant par, plus proche de nous, l'American Center ou la Fondation Vuitton, sont des visiteurs des musées, puisque vos architectures abritent très souvent peintures et sculptures, un peu à la façon des églises baroques romaines, ce qui ne veut pas dire qu'on va au musée comme on va à la messe, encore que dans certains cas, mais bon. Mais vos constructions, qui étonnent souvent par leur forme et par l'éclectisme des matériaux utilisés, concernent aussi les maisons et les immeubles d'habitation, sans omettre les lieux de savoir et de production des connaissances. On pense à la bibliothèque Lewis de l'Université de Princeton et au Center Stata, que j'ai eu le plaisir de visiter il y a quelques années avec mon ancien mentor du MIT, le professeur Uttam Rajbandari. Avec vous, le Collège accueille une très grande personnalité de l'art contemporain, qui, jouant avec les codes de l'architecture, en a redéfini jusqu'à la notion. Nous sommes impatients de vous entendre ce soir, comme nous le sommes de découvrir bientôt votre bâtiment d'Arles, en attendant la suite. Il me reste à remercier la Fondation Hugo, clé de voûte de cette manifestation et de toutes les manifestations de ce type que nous avons au Collège, qui enrichissent la vie intellectuelle de cette maison et bien au-delà. Bonne soirée à tous.
Many thanks, Alain, for this wonderful introduction to our conversation. So I'm very happy to greet Franck Guéry in this auditorium. After having taught 9 lessons about his work, this is the best, the most wonderful conclusion we could have dreamt of. Franck has opened, as you know, now 2.5 years ago, the building of the Vuitton Foundation in the Bois de Boulogne. But Paris had been an early love in his life. And I wanted...
C'est vrai.
And I wanted to maybe to start this conversation by getting back to the Paris you had discovered, to your early experiences in Paris in 1960 and 1961. This sojourn in Paris took place between the construction of your first building, the Steve's House in Brentwood, which was full of rather anxious allusions to Frank Lloyd Wright and Japanese architecture.
Yes, that's true.
And then your second building, which no one today would consider as a Frank Gehry building, but yet is full of extremely imaginative solutions, the Hillcrest Apartments in Santa Monica. So between these two build projects, you are in Paris and you work with André Remondet. Mm.
That's true.
So can you say something about Remondet and this time in Paris?
Well, I came with a family, a wife and child, two daughters, and one of her best friends was a was French, a pen pal, and that after I got out of the army, I went to Harvard to study city planning, which was the wrong thing for me to be studying, so I was in the wrong section, but I met a French architect studying at Harvard under José Luis Sert. His name was Marc Biasse. We became close friends. He came to LA and visited in LA and then invited us to come to France and found us an apartment. 60 Route des Gardes, deuxième sous-sol. We looked out in the garden and there was a creche and it was perfect for the girls. And I was trying to find a job. I tried to get a job with Candelis, Josic, and Woods because I had a connection to Josic. But they only paid 2 francs per hour. I couldn't find a job, and I had a connection through my old office in LA to Raymonde, who always welcomed an American. He loved to have one American in the office. That was his badge of honor or something, you know. And he was a terrific man, terrific guy, very friendly, very open, very trusting, and he paid me 4 francs an hour. And so I worked 4 days a week with him, and he used to introduce me to everyone proudly, "It's our American." And on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we drove to as far as a car could go for come back to Belgium and Holland and Italy and wherever, and visited the monuments that we'd heard about.
We'll get back to that. Huh? We'll get to that in a minute. Raymonde was is an unknown character now. He had spent the war, the Second World War, in the U.S. That's yeah. why he loved young American architects. He had succeeded, he had replaced Perret at the Ecole des Beaux-Arts, and he built some structures in Paris, in particular the big white banana-shaped building close to the Maison de Radio France in the 16th, which is not the most glorious structure you can find in Paris. But you also worked for an interesting character, Ozel.
Well, Marc Biasse was working with Ozel. I never actually met Ozel. We were working with Ivan Yankovic, who
his
was
partner,
and we were doing studies of community. I forget what they were doing, but one of them was a study for Villa Kublai, which was interesting. But it was an interesting time in Paris because. The young Claude Perron was already talking about Paris à côté.
Paris parallèle.
Parallèle. Oh, yeah. I remember à côté, so I'm sorry. And he had an afro, a big guy. And I don't think anybody here saw him that way, but and he was very friendly and included me. And I was introduced to a lot of the architects and...
Yes, one of them was this guy, Anatole Kopp.
Yes. Anatole Kopp. One of the partners in the Gruen office in LA was a close friend of Anatole Kopp. And they went to school together at MIT, I think.
Yes.
And he introduced me to Anatole Kopp, who was very friendly, took us into his house, invited us to dinner. I realized he was a complete communist and had great passion for the people. And I loved, you know, at that age, that was great. I spent hours talking to him. And one night I was there for dinner with a cartoonist for Le Monde called Tim.
Mittelberg, or Tim, yes.
Tim. And it was the night that the Algerian generals were supposed to come to Le Bourget.
And
Villers-Coublay. And Anatole was preparing for this meeting. And after dinner, he got in his car. He had a gun and everything, and he went to meet the generals to tell them not to start a war, that we could be friends. Of course, they never came, but I loved all that. I got a sense of France and the French people at that time that, you know, put a stamp on me that I'll never forget, and created a love for this country, I think, which I haven't lost.
This is wonderful to hear. So probably on your weekend escapades, you did it as far as Ronchamp?
Yes. One of the professors at Harvard, I'm going to forget his name.
Zaleski?
Yeah, Joseph Zalewski was in Paris. He'd worked with Korb, and he invited us to go to on a trip to Ronchamp and to the monastery.
La Tourette.
La Tourette. And took us, I still haven't gotten over both those buildings. They just printed in my head. How powerful they were, the church in Tourette, which implied the cross, and there was something spectacular. And of course, Ronchamp, I think whenever I go, I try to go at least every other year or so, for a transfusion. It makes me cry. And now I can't see it because some guy put a thing at the bottom which interrupts the hill, the beautiful sight. This sight, you have a slot at the bottom that...
Here. This guy is Renzo Piano, if I may.
Where is he?
But you were not only interested in modern architecture. I remember I was a fly on the wall where you got your first Legion of Honor medal, and the minister was really insisting heavily on the impact of Le Corbusier on your work, and you said, no, the most important character is Gislibertus, and you mentioned Autun.
Entrance by Gislibertus. I found the sculpture in Autun because when you come out of architecture school, you think of historic buildings as decoration, and modernism was already trying to simplify and toughen, but it cleaned everything, got rid of everything. And so some of the cherubs and angels and things like that, I didn't miss those. But when I got to Autun and saw the toughness, is the only way to describe it, of those sculptures, that they weren't, they didn't have that saccharinely quality. They had a feeling that transcended the age that was still vital, still valuable. And visiting the Romanesque churches was, I think, one of the major enlightenments, say, of my life here.
So when you return to LA, you start your office and try to get commissions in all the realms of Los Angeles economy. Many projects date back from these years. Yet your relationship with Paris at some time seems to be returning. I found in your own archives 2 weeks ago this little invitation to an exhibition of projects for La Défense, where you're featured along with some artists like Larry Bell or Robert Owen, who were your friends.
We were invited to the museum here, it was Beaubourg, I think.
Yes.
By Germain Viette. Is he still?
Germain Viette is still around, who was curator at the Pompidou.
Maybe he's here. Hello. Who invited a group from LA? I think it was a kind of a token invitation that they weren't really that interested in what these people were doing, but they thought there was a lot of noise in Southern California that was starting to bubble into the art world in New York. And so they were curious, so they invited some people, and I was thrown into the pack, and we came, and we didn't do very much.
Anyway, I think it's a good indication of your close relationship with the Los Angeles artistic scene. Larry Bell, who was a sculptor and worked essentially with glass and
still does.
And still does, but with whom you had close contact for some of your works, he advised you for some of your works. Erwin, who was engaged in your attempts to produce cardboard furniture.
Well, some of those were great, but the best part of it was that there was something different in my heart and soul that I was trying to talk about when I started. And it was not very well received by my colleagues in California. The architects that belong to the organizations that you belong to in architecture were very critical of what I was doing. I can see that I wasn't consistent. I was trying things. So I could do the house that's influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright. I could do a building that was Monterey Spanish. I was exploring, and people didn't understand what I was trying to do. And as the construction started on a small building, a Danziger, a small studio for a graphic designer, during the construction, several artists used to appear on site, and that was curious and welcomed. And they were consistent. They came back and saw it and befriended me, invited me to their dinners, their soirees, their evenings, their events. And I knew their artwork already. I was already pretty well studied in their work. So it was a very welcoming alternative to the disdain I was getting from my fellow architects. And so I became part of this, socially at least, became part of this group, and found comfort in their support of what I was doing. I found inspiration in what they were doing. I liked the directness of their ideas to production, which I found difficult in architecture. It's, you have to go through so many people to get a building built that you lose a lot of the feeling and spirit. And so that experience gave me courage to keep to explore a different direction. And so,
which is extremely well represented by your house, yes. Which was considered when it was built in 78 as breaking the rules of architecture.
Yeah, so you have to understand something about this house. That it was an existing house, and all I had was $50,000 to spend on it.
Maybe on peut avoir un peu. Can we have more control? Less light. Peut diminuer la lumière. Je trouve le contraste pas très bon.
So you understand what I'm saying?
Yes. 50,000.
It wasn't a lot of money. So it's crazy that if you only spend $50,000. You can create that much fuss and people coming and photographing the New York Times. It was crazy. I couldn't believe what happened. And it made me realize, and it's instilled a kind of confidence in me that it's not how much money you spend on a building. And I think it's been a powerful driver for me that, like Bilbao was built for $300 a square foot in 97, it's pretty cheap.
Yes.
So that positive, that started there, that you didn't.
And at some time you theorized this attitude when you talked from the poster for lecture you gave in Houston about cheapskate architecture, une architecture de radin. So you had a theory about it.
Yeah, because first of all, I had no work. I was just, and so this was something that was interesting to talk about, and people who didn't have a lot of money were interested in talking to me about it, because could they have something for not a lot of money?
Anyway, that's the moment when people start writing about you in the US, in Italy, people like Germano Celant, here Olivier Boissier, myself a little bit in 81, François Chalin, who's here, even tried to make an exhibition at the newly created Institut Français d'Architecture. And you get invited to a first competition in Nîmes.
Oh. So, I went to Nîmes. It's crazy. I knew Maison Carré from architectural history, and I'd seen it before in my travels. I spent time at Maison Carré. I went and spent time in the plaza and the space, and didn't want to copy Maison Carré. There was a row of columns that existed that maybe had to stay and maybe not. And I was advised at some point they didn't have to stay, so we made a design that I thought included references to the culture around Maison Carré, the bullfights, life of that region. It's very complicated. It got simpler than this, what you're looking at. But Jim Sterling was on the jury, and the other contestants were Jean Nouvel and Norman Foster. And I think somebody else, but I can't remember. Jean Nouvel made a flat plaza and built the building underground. That was his idea, which maybe would have been the best idea. But Norman Foster did what they built now, what they've built. He won the competition. But he, Jim Sterling, I was in a meeting with Jim Sterling and Norman, and Jim said that he had to leave the columns, the existing columns, and Norman agreed. And then after Jim left, Norman proposed taking the columns down. So it was a normal kind of interaction.
He made in the end Norman Foster build some slender columns. So he made an allusion to the colonnade of Maison Carré.
But if you go, I mean, Norman's a friend, and I don't want to be a critic of him. But there one thing I do critique is that when you go to the foyer on the ground floor and you look at Maison Carré, it cuts off the top. So you don't see
the pediment,
the head. And when you go upstairs to the main overlook from the top, it cuts off the bottom. So the relationship between the new building, the only way you get it is if you go outside, which I guess is okay, but I found that a little disturbing. But other than that?
Other than that, 1987, a commission is envisioned in as one of the folies in the Parc de la Villette as designed by Bernard Tschumi. And here you had an opportunity to bring to Paris these fish-shaped buildings which you had started developing.
I can take all night on this one. I don't know how much time you have. First of all, why the fish, and then why the fish here? When I looked at modernism with its cubist kind of rationalist kind of language, as it was being built commercially and across the world, it had no feeling. There was no, I didn't sense any kind of engagement. It was just that. And so I thought there must be a way to do something about that, to find a language that would do something. The postmodern show, Beaux-Arts show at the MoMA, in an instant transformed all the architects across the world into restudying, reusing, ornament from the past, from the Beaux-Arts, from the past. I gave a lecture and I was very angry about it, I remember, and I said, why do you have to, can't you find a way to go forward? Do you have to go back? It seems like a loss. It seems like you're abandoning your job. Your role is to interpret the time you're in and to make places for people that have feeling now without playing the soft trip. And in that lecture, I said, Greek temples are anthropomorphic. If you got to go back, why don't you go back 300 million years before man to fish? Now, why I said fish, don't ask me. That came out. There's stories about the fish in my grandmother's bathtub and all that stuff. But what I realized when I started drawing it, started thinking about it, I realized I was looking for what do you do to replace ornament. And 19th century ornament. And I thought that we're living in a society that has movement, cars, planes, trucks, boats, everything moving. Is there something there? And I was looking for that. And I started looking at the woodcuts by Hiroshige, the Japanese woodcut artist. And they're very beautiful, they're very architectural. They have movement, they have beautiful scale, they have... And I became enamored with that idea of trying to translate that into an architectural form. And I did a fish for a fashion house in Florence because I started making fish lamps and stupid things with fish. Motif, as you know, I was searching. And this fashion house in Florence asked me to do an exhibit at the Pitti Palace. And they asked me if I could use a fish motif. They liked this idea. So I went to Cinecittà and I got them to build for me a 35-foot long fish out of wood. And the fish had eyes and fins and tails. And it was the most embarrassing piece of kitsch that one could imagine. And I looked at it and I said, oh God. It was taken to the Castello di Rivoli in Torino for an exhibit. And it was alone in a room. And I stood beside it and I was sure it moved. And I thought, uh-huh.
I got something
here. So I went home and I had an opportunity to build an exhibit with a fish in it. So in this exhibit, I cut off the tail, I cut off the head, I cut off the fins. I made a very abstract fish. And
this was Minneapolis, the Walker.
Minneapolis, the Walker. And it's still, you stood beside it and you still had that feeling. So I was very heartened by it and it, blah, blah, blah. Japan asked me to do an Italian restaurant in Kobe. Italian restaurant. A lot of meetings, a lot of sake, a lot of Kobe beef. Everything was beautiful. They wanted a fish. I didn't want to do it. We did studies. I couldn't figure out how the language misunderstanding was terrible. I won't go into it, but it was. I couldn't get a sense of cost. I couldn't get a sense of anything. And finally, they called me desperately and they said on a Friday night at midnight, they called me LA time and said, Frank's son, we have to have the completed design by Monday morning. And since it's, we'll do the work for it, we just need your permission to use your name. I said, you can't do that. So, several calls later, at 2 a.m. they called, and at 4 a.m. they called. It kept waking me up, and this is Friday night, so it's already Saturday morning, and they need it Monday in Japan. So it's already Sunday in Japan. So I said, okay. So I had a friend, a colleague in the office spoke Japanese. I took a fish design from one of the models. I put it there. I took the snake design from one of the models and put it there. And I put a slice from a house I did for an artist and put it there. I sent Greg with the model to Japan. They approved it, and this is what they built.
And what about...
And it's not an Italian restaurant.
And what about La Villette? The La Villette project.
La Villette.
You remember how it happened? This fish you designed for La Villette as a restaurant. See? Oh. It's more or less the same configuration.
Yeah, I forgot that one.
Yeah, but you see it's already, it's slightly later. So it's, you are reconfiguring the same elements on the ground.
I was laying down the fish, yes.
Yes. Okay. Paris, finally you managed to build a project in Paris, but not exactly in Paris. It's in a sort of imitation city east of Paris called Disneyland.
Euro Disney.
Euro Disney. So this is the model, this is the building,
I only went once and I've never been again.
You should. It has been slightly damaged, yet the night view is, I think, used to be something quite interesting. Not because your architecture was hidden, but because the structure of it was quite interesting. In particular, and here at dusk, I've always found that there was something, the way you had created a room in the open was quite stimulating. But it's...
It was not a very good experience for me because Disney had a mandate for a certain thing, and the other architects fit better into it than I did. I mean, they built it, but then they dismantled it. I think they tear parts of it
apart. Not completely. No. Some things can still be seen.
Yeah. Maybe I'll go.
Let's go there one day. second project in Paris, also related with the American presence.
This was for me, it was an important project. Very nice clients, people that understood or wanted something special. They gave me a program. I was trying to build flats, which is in the left-hand side of the thing, and then a museum space. And a theater. The theater was for 400 or 450 people. And it turned out to be a very special theater. And Pierre Boulez, when he saw it, was excited. He was going to use it for his work at the time. I don't know what happened. It fell apart. It was not financed or something. But
yes, the project shrunk to a certain degree in respect to these sketches, which was rather more ambitious. The project was compressed in a certain
degree. Yeah, they had money problems, fundraising, normal issues. I don't really know. I didn't go behind the curtain very much.
It's also a project in which you seem to have been.
I'm proud of it. Yes. I love it's the time where we used the galvanized metal for the window frames, and I still love that.
Yes, you had a clearly here you made an attempt to adjust to the skin of Paris buildings.
Yeah.
To the stone, to the zinc of the.
I used Paris stone that I thought was Paris stone. Yes, I was trying to do a Paris building, and I was trying to relate to the scale of the buildings
nearby,
some of them at the time, Portsmouth Park was starting to do.
Yes, but there was a very nice line of buildings facing the Parc de Bercy, which are still standing, and I think, again, a place to be revisited.
Yeah.
This is the interior, which later became the Cinémathèque, the film museum.
Yeah, I don't know what other people. I'm still happy with this building.
It's wonderful. Now another one that did not materialize. Your competition for Rennes.
Rennes. So we were asked to do what was it?
It was a cultural center, library, museum, and auditorium.
Yeah, I forget. Yeah, we worked very hard on Rennes. It was a competition, and then Christian Portsmouth Park won. And then I found out his mother lived in Rennes. And then years later, I entered a competition in Casablanca, which he also won. Is he here?
I don't know. I invited him, but...
And then I found out he was from Casablanca, so I'm careful when I enter.
So there seems to be a malediction.
But anyway.
So there is the big breakthrough in your work with Bilbao. Very important building because of its program, because of its location, also because of your design strategy as you're using for the first time at such a scale computers, not simply to make images or calculations, but really to design and build the structure.
And we were partnering with a French software company, so you can be happy. At Dassault Systems was, I met Bernard Charles and told him what I was trying to do, and he helped me get the proper software, and we were able to simplify the software and partner with them to create a software that was usable for the construction industry. The things that are important to me are the buildability and I try to control everything. Not always can, but in Bilbao we were able to, and so the bidding process for the building with Spanish contractors who looked at this thing and said, oh my God, what are we doing? The steel bids from six bidders were within 1% of each other, and they were 18% under budget. So when the spread of six bidders is tight, then you can be confident that and they stuck to the promise. So, and no two pieces of steel are the same size. So you can do that.
One of the interesting aspects of your work is precisely the encounter between the digital technology and the history of art. So this is the Horsehead meeting room in the DZ Bank building in Berlin, which has been related to your experience in Dijon. Can you be specific about this?
See, I always come back to France for my inspiration.
No, that's what I wanted to say.
I know where you're going. A great historian friend of mine from Princeton, Irving Levin, took me to Dijon, to the asylum, and we went in and saw the fountain with Moses and incredible work. I'd never seen it before. And I fell to my knees with beauty. And then we saw the sarcophagus of Philip the Bold with the small figures, the mourners called by Klaus Schluter. And you realize Klaus Schluter was before Michelangelo.
Late 14th century.
Yeah, so this kind of fluidity with stone is so powerful. I was just the ability to do that. And we still, I'm still influenced by these, inspired by these figures. And with the computer, we can build it. So.
Now I wanted to discuss, to ask you some questions or to induct you to talk a little bit about your relationship with music and about musical buildings. Because I think it's one of the Pierre Boulez Salle was opened in Berlin earlier this year. You have a long trail of projects dealing with music. And I wanted to backtrack a little bit to, so you started with the with one music pavilion in Maryland, then the Hollywood Bowl renovation in Los Angeles, and I found these views where, which are very telling about the way you work with people, the user, Ernest Fleischmann, at the bottom, the acoustician, Christopher Jaffe, who had a major contribution to the acoustics of concert hall, on top, and yourself with the tubes you used in this building.
So the Hollywood Bowl amphitheater is a, like this shape, and it focuses the sound, and it was like a trumpet. So in the 20s or 30s when it was built, I forget when.
28.
28? Hmm? Yeah, something like that. The acoustician was somebody I actually got to know. The only way to project sound was this trumpet shape out to the valley, out to the hills. The problem was that because it focused the sound, the musicians on stage could not hear each other. So even if I was on stage talking to, and I experienced this, you wouldn't hear me, I couldn't hear you. It went up and
got lost.
And so they were trying to solve this problem, and they had very little money to do it. And they asked me if I could do it, and I met Chris Jaffe, who they selected, the acoustician. And we tried, talked about a lot of things, but there was nothing. At that time, concrete was being poured into these cardboard tubes. They still do it for columns. And the cardboard tubes had some density, and they were very cheap. So we could buy for $10,000 enough cardboard tubes to fill that auditorium. And we tried it, and it did diffuse the sound. So it didn't project the sound, but it neutralized the effect of this shape so that people on stage could hear each other. And then they could amplify that with loudspeakers to the audience. So that's all we did.
Then you did, and maybe I will be faster, then you did a second version in which you used fiberglass.
So every few years they brought a new acoustician. So they brought an Israeli guy, and he said it was better with spheres, so we made these plastic spheres, which did the same thing, I think, more expensively. But
then you worked also with Jaffe on the Concord Auditorium in the Bay Area, yep, east of San Francisco, which was considered as one of the, as the best outdoor musical stage
so
this, in the U.S.
I'd never been to Bayreuth to experience the Wagner pit, but the folklore was that the orchestra played under the stage, which, you know, we've all seen pictures, and some of you have probably been there, and that it was it really worked. So we tried to emulate that under this circular stage in the front. The space goes down, and there is the orchestra, like in the Bayreuth pit. And it really worked. At that same time, I was at a concert in New York, Philharmonic, where a young French conductor named Pierre Boulez was conducting, and he had put the seating on the stage on rugs. It's called the rug concert. And I was lucky enough to sit on a rug facing Pierre Boulez. I had heard a little bit about him. I didn't know him. He conducted within this frame. He never went out here. Very very, it was dreamlike and so beautiful, and I just couldn't believe it. It was just so magical that when the concert was over, I did something I rarely do. I ran up and talked to him. And coincidentally, he knew Ernest Fleischman from L.A., so we talked.
The director of the
director. He said he was coming to L.A. and we could get together. And I told him about Concord, so he came over the hill, and the orchestra was in, you couldn't see them, and he was quite taken with it. And then, anyway, it led to a continuing friendship at the Ojai Festival, LA Philharmonic, where his very first concert with the LA Philharmonic, people walked out. I was at that concert, people walked out on him. It was very painful for him. It hurt him terribly, as it would.
So let's go to LA with a new home of the New York, of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, the Walt Disney Concert Hall. Maybe very quickly, let's leaf through the sketch of yours, the model, and in the end, the building. So how did your knowledge and your taste for music play into this very complex design, which took so long to implement?
When I was a kid, my mother used to take me to concerts in Toronto. She played violin, so she was interested in music. The family was very poor, so it was difficult, but she did get me to hear classical music, and then all through my life after that, I listened to classical music. I'm a pure dilettante. I don't profess to be an expert on any of it. But it stayed with me in architecture and college. And then when I started with Fleischman with the Hollywood Bowl and did that work, I became part of the family of the LA Philharmonic, and I got to meet with Pierre quite often, and so.
And the last episode is the most recent one, this auditorium in Berlin, which is celebrating Pierre.
Pierre had always wanted Salma Dilab, which was, He had difficulty explaining it, actually, because I had a meeting here with students at the IRCOM, and the students were trying to design as a student project, Salma Dilab. And so one of the students asked Pierre, Maestro Boulez, what is the single most important issue for Salma Dilab? And I don't know if anybody's experienced or knew him, but he very sweetly said, but of course, you know, we have to find a way to bring the piano on stage quietly. You know, I could have. It was like his conducting, like everything, like the man, like the person. It was so simple, so perfect. He became such a hero. So when this project came up, it was by accident, I became involved with the Divan Orchestra, which has Israelis, Palestinians playing together, and the belief that through art people can communicate. It's a great idea, it does work. It's not used very much, but this orchestra with Barenboim that was started with Edward Said represented that and was very beautiful. And I was raised in a Jewish family. I grew up through the years when the state of Israel was being created, and I have gone there. I tried to work there. I didn't enjoy that. And I was disappointed in what's going on now in Israel. And so I didn't want to abandon the idea that through the arts we could speak to each other and that the Israelis with their music could. And so I became interested in the Divan Orchestra. And it led to me volunteering my services to do this. So we did it as a gift for the Divan. And Daniel and I decided to name it for Pierre. So it's called Pierre Boulez Hall. And it's the closest thing to a Salman Jalam. And I took the maquette to him in Baden-Baden. That's the picture. 3 months before he died. And we gave him the model, and he was very, very happy about it. Anyway.
À propos historical connections, you sent me this picture, I think, in January of this year.
Yeah, so the Boulez Hall is an oval. And it's inside an office building. You have to understand, there was no outside to it. It's an office building. And we built this oval arena, small, for 700 seats inside. And my friend who took me to see Schluter in Dijon got this picture and he put it into Borromini. And it fit, so.
The oval fits, but the oval is also becomes a very flexible configuration. Here yeah. We have some views of this project, which works so well. So back to Paris and to the Vuitton Foundation.
This was also emotional when I met Bernard Arnault and he said, come in my car, I want to show you a site. He took me to Jardin d'Acclimatation, and when I realized where we were and what he wanted to do there, I became emotional and I did actually cry. I get very emotional about this. So I cried because I realized that that Proust must have certainly played there with his friends, and this was going to touch the French history and in a way, an important way, and I love that idea. So.
So the development of the project was a very lengthy affair in which one sees your typical strategy. People consider that you're sculpting architecture, but in fact you start, as shown here, by a very rational consideration of the users and the volumes.
We tried to understand the program of what was needed by the client, what he wanted to achieve.
Could you be called a functionalist in this respect?
Maybe. I don't mind. I think it's. I'm not threatened by a client. I think a client, especially a strong client, I love it, because they usually know what they want, and they can interact at a level that leads to something special. And that was the case here. Monsieur Arnault, as many of you know, plays concert, the classical music by himself on the piano. His family is all involved with classical music. It's very important to him in his life. And so we connected. We built a small auditorium where some great musicians come. The issue for us in this project was that it was difficult to build in the Bois de Boulogne. The sensitivity to, even though there are some buildings that are modernist and like the D'Aubusson building, and there was a bowling alley on this site, there was a need to have this discussion about what is appropriate and so on. And we talked about the history of garden buildings, glass buildings, and it was that discussion that led to this idea of a building with a glass
envelope,
which gave it a reason to be in the garden.
But also you had to go beyond what had been done in Bilbao, and this is what you've done. I'm very quick here, but this is what you've done in working on the sales, but by creating a sort of building within a building.
Right, yeah.
Which was a way of also of capturing views.
Yes.
And framing views on Paris.
And then the space between, we've always said, should invite artists to come and play. And we did, and my friend Daniel Buran came, but he didn't go inside. He built his building on top of my building.
So is it fair to say that there is still an untapped potential in that building for site-specific works?
I think so. I hope so. Not as aggressive as Daniel, maybe, but...
But it's gone now.
Well, he's a good friend of mine, so I love... You know, I knew he would be that way, but... So I kind of was complicit in inviting him.
Well, and now you're working on a nearby project. Can you tell us something about a project which is still rather mysterious?
It's not mysterious. It's been there. It's a building that is protected, has a protected designation. It hasn't been given the love it needs, so it's kind of looks not so great. And Monsieur Arnault wants to bring it back to life and create a place for craft, to celebrate craft, the art of craft, and bring the various arts together in it. I don't think his program is 1,000,000% settled. It will evolve, but we're now selecting the glass, and then by miracle, D'Aubuisson, the architect's grandson, worked in my office. So he's in charge of the patrimony, I think, and so we were able to talk together, and he collaborated with us on the design. So by Parazar, as you say, it worked out to be a good relationship. I think it's going to be an interesting pavilion-type building that's going to have a lot of different uses over time that will be invented as we go, not necessarily set now.
Well, I do think that it's a very interesting move if compared to the nearby building. If compared to other buildings you've done in the past where your additions, I would say, were sometimes, forgive me, but deathly embraces, where you swallowed the existing buildings into one of your own constructs, and here one senses, maybe it's getting back to the generation of Raymondet and all these guys, one senses that you have tried to adjust to the existing structure.
Well,
more
you don't
than
have
elsewhere.
A picture of the Berlin building outside, but I did that there.
Yes.
The bank. And the concert hall in Miami is rectilinear. I'm not against that. I just want to have the feeling in it. I don't want to have a cold.
And you've even done invisible buildings, or almost invisible buildings. I'm thinking of your addition to the Norton Simon in Pasadena, which yeah. is almost invisible. Last project in course of completion is the Luma Foundation in Arles. where you've dealt with an ancient city. So you had
It's a Roman city.
A rather complex historical setting.
It's a Roman city with two Roman amphitheaters. And there were, when the Roman city was built, the smaller buildings are clustered with tile roofs and things against. So there's it's a mélange of against this. And we're on the main highway. On the main road. This street here.
Yeah.
And our client has been, Luma Foundation has been building this environment for her photography shows and other art shows that she's planning. And I became excited about the Roman amphitheater idea. So the circle in the middle became the foyer that the building grows out of, and it's glass, and so it's kind of a nod to the Romans, maybe.
And again, we see how your working methodology develops out of this accumulation and assembly of volumes, which slowly...
Well, these are the program.
Yes.
Are all the different colors.
This is the components of a program which has kept changing, if I know well.
And then we studied many different types of exterior models. We look at the surrounding, you look at Alpi, the hills, and the way the light hits that. And then the great Van Gogh painting, Starry Night. And I found some inspiration. And I thought that if the skin of, and Maya Hoffman, who's the client, saw a building that wasn't being built, where I used a kind of a very rough formed exterior, and she liked that. And we explored using a metallic surface with these blocks that on the outside, do you have a, go back to the hot
side. Yes.
So, the first one, yeah, there. So when the light hits that, it will paint with the light, and we've built mock-ups of it, both in Arl and at my office in our lot. And the light changes and creates a beautiful, almost a very feminine touch of light on the building. I'm very excited about what's going to happen.
So this is the model of the interior. And
it's under construction.
This is construction going on. And yes, here we see how the skin is concealed, the blocks.
And it changes color. It's just amazing, yeah. Oh.
Well, now, as a final topic, I wanted to bring you back to Los Angeles, where you're playing a relatively unexpected role. Throughout your life, you've been interested in urban design. You mentioned it at the beginning. And your architecture, in general, is considered as working against the city, but it is, in most cases, very closely determined by the urban setting. But this time, things are different. This time, you're operating at a scale of a gigantic infrastructure, i.e. the Los Angeles River.
I was invited by the mayor of Los Angeles to give him an idea of how to make something out of the LA River. I don't know if you know, in New York, there was some derelict railroad bridges that were rusting, and the people put plants on them, and they became a cause célèbre, and it's called the High Line, and the land values went up all around, and everybody's excited about this bridge, and it's a mile and a half long. And so the mayor said, we have a 51-mile river. Can you do the same with the river? I said, okay, maybe. My time was all volunteer. It was not a, he wasn't offering me a job. He was offering me a...
A cause.
Something, I don't know what it was. He was giving me a hot potato. We studied it for 3 years, and all of the work that's been done in Los Angeles River have been to try and connect recreation and habitat, so birds and fish and frogs and stuff. And there was support for that from the technical departments of the government, the Corps of Engineers, for the last 20 years have been supporting that effort. And so we assumed that was a, could be done. And we did lots of studies and tried to follow that line of thinking. And we hit complete dead end. We didn't know where to go. And last October, published in the Los Angeles paper, was a warning about the LA River flooding and displacing several thousand homes. So I called the Corps of Engineers and asked them how they could continue with habitat when, and finally we got the truth that you cannot continue with habitat, it's not possible. The flood control project is flood control, and recreation is not safe in flood control, et cetera, et cetera. So in that, how do you, this river goes through areas, the picture on the left here, the red are the neighborhoods in south of Los Angeles to Long Beach, where there is no open space for the families, zero. No gardens, no parks, nothing. And the health problems are enormous, and the costs are in the 60, 70 billion tax costs to help these people for the health problems. Also, the city is wasting a billion or more gallons of water daily, or yearly or weekly, I forget which, but they're wasting a lot of water going out into the ocean in a time of drought where the community needs water. So in order to reclaim the water, you have to have land to put aside. You have to acquire a land almost like the Indian step wells, if you know those in Indian Ahmedabad, where the water fills the step well and then it slowly goes down. A similar, not a deep step well, but you need a piece of land and you can't acquire it. It's not available in these places, so they're stuck. So there's no land, they need parks, and so the obvious thing was, great, we own the land that the river is in, why not cover the river, make it a park? You would then have 51 miles of park joining Los Angeles from 51 miles. You can do recreation habitat, you can have small rivers, safe rivers on top, and so on and so forth. And the edge of the space, the edge of the park, creates enormous value for development. If it's done properly, won't destroy the character of it. Over time and rather quickly, it would pay for the whole operation. So we have been proposing that. And we've been meeting with all of the neighbors and people, and it looks like, you know, I promise not to talk about Trump tonight because I hate him, but and thank God for your guy. But why did I bring him up? I can't remember why I brought him. Yeah, infrastructure, maybe, yes. So, because we have, I know why, the California politicians, including our governor, Jerry Brown, and the Speaker of the House and the senators, the day after the election of Trump, published a manifesto against Trump. So California, we may secede from the union because these guys are the good guys. I'm working with them on the lower part of the river, trying to create, we have a way to create a park the size of Central Park, New York, which is 800 acres, by covering the river and creating recreation for all of, in the middle of all this red. And I'm very excited about it, and I'm spending lots of time on it.
And you're also spending, and this is final story, you're also spending time with other programs. Can you say something about this?
Yeah, I guess.
Philanthropic program you're developing?
Well, I've always been interested in arts education. You know, I don't know in France what the education arts is in the elementary schools, but in the U.S. it's been removed. There's no more arts education. No more. Nothing. Zero. And the dropout of children after the fifth grade is very high in many schools. And in California alone, there's over 100 schools where the dropout rate is significant. And so you can multiply that by across the whole of the United States. It's a significant figure. And the prisons in the United States prepare their facilities for the future based on this statistic of the dropout. That's the setting. So I've decided that I'm going to do something because I like that problem. And I hired a friend, and we've created a Michelle Obama started a project like that with the White House when she was there, and we've connected to that, and we're we now have, my foundation, or whatever you call what I do, has 16 schools in California. And we brought David Hockney a few weeks ago to school. These kids are homeless. 60% of the kids in this school are homeless. David Hockney came and he brought some flower vases and some flowers, and he put the flowers in the vase, and at his computer he drew a picture while the kids were watching, and then we gave each of the kids a computer, and they drew these, and we showed them how to do it. And is there more?
No, then we have some fish. Back to
okay.
Fish.
So those kids, those pictures, they had their picture taken with David Hockney, showing his picture with their pictures. Their pictures are going to be enlarged and put into the offices at Facebook in California. And then the kids are going to be invited to Facebook to see their pictures on the wall. Now, these are homeless kids. So it's called Turnaround Arts, but it does start to work. It's slow, but it's one way. So I'm involved with that.
I have a last question, but no slide, because it's a secret project, but maybe you can say something about it. A project that takes us away from Los Angeles. If I remember well, you've been contacted by the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena,
yeah.
The organization that works on space ships, and we're asked to help them to develop a program. Can you say something specific about it?
It's not as it's exciting, but it's not as exciting as yet, as you think, but I think it will be. I've always been interested in anything that expands your ideas of stuff. They have a program called Atelier, so it's a very French name, where they get 20 or 30 young scientists with hoodies and computers, and they sit around with NASA in the room, a NASA representative, and they try to design a space capsule that goes to Europa, which is a satellite that goes around Jupiter, and they go there because they found moisture in the air, in the atmosphere, so they want to find out. And so I was invited to sit there with them for 3 days.
Do they want a Bilbao-like spaceship?
No. They just asked me to sit there and if I had any ideas to talk. So they were, after about an hour, I felt I got involved. I was could understand what they were doing. The problems were understandable. They weren't so abstract physics or stuff. They were trying to design a capsule that had the least amount of weight. Right? And they were designing systems for it that I saw were counterproductive to that. And so I pointed it out that they had a battery pack and it was based on the circular batteries, and so the space between the batteries was wasted. And so I asked them why they did that. And they said, well, it's a system designed. The NASA guy said, it's done, don't bother us, we can't change it. That was 11 a.m. At noon, at 2 o'clock after lunch, the NASA guy came in and said, our system failed, do you have another system? And so my system then became used for the Europa battery pack. So,
which was transforming, if I remember well, using the skin.
Yeah.
As the battery.
Right.
Well, I think this is a very good way of concluding this conversation. From domestic space to outer space, your engagement...
I'll go anywhere.
In all the scales of architecture, your readiness to face every possible adventure and the people who are developing these adventures is an example for all of us. Thanks very much.